Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In the year 1659, the Toulouse Dominican Jean-Baptiste Gonnet published the first volume and edition of his famous Clippius Theologiae Thomistice contra novos eius impugnatores, which, as we know, is the shield of Thomistic theology against its new assailants. Noting that his was a, quote, fertile age of genius, Gonnet deigns to break the deliberate silence and what he calls the peaceful repose of the 17th century Thomist school, amid so many tumults stirred up, as he says, in the Republic of Letters. He is compelled to offer a fresh presentation of Thomistic theology because he considers his to be a time characterized by an unparalleled devising of perilous opinions, which he says, quote, some contrived to the ruin of the church, others fashioned to the destruction of souls. The poetic Amico Lectori preface to Gonnet's Clippius reveals an author who is not merely an intellectual fixated upon concepts and ideas, but a religious and a priest consecrated to the truth and for the salvation of souls. He is intent to cover the whole of the Sacra Doctrina with punctilious fidelity to the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas in a way that is pleasant to read, he emphasizes this, and useful for the critical needs of his time. Unsurprisingly then, predestination enjoys prominent placement and extensive treatment in Gonnet's Clippius. He is not naive about what this doctrine demands of the theologian. At the beginning of his Tractatus on Predestination, he writes the following words of caution to those whom he addresses as dear readers. So this is Gonnet. He says, we enter a vast sea, famous for the shipwrecks of many, when we undertake to explain the hidden mystery of predestination. Its immensity swallowed up the minds of many, and with sacred dread, it shakes even the loftiest pillars of heaven, which, he points out, St. Gregory interprets as the angels or the holy doctors of the church. For however much anyone may advance in truth, however much he may grow in knowledge, it is not enough to penetrate the way in which our Creator rules us by the governance of his judgments. And that's him citing St. Gregory. Undaunted himself, however, Gonnet then proceeds to sail into this vast sea of predestination, relying upon the cartography of his Thomistic predecessors. And he expounds at great length and with fine intricacy the nuances of this doctrine, secundum scholam Thomisticam. Not all of Gonnet's literary contemporaries, however, appreciated how the Thomistic school habitually navigated through predestination's waters. During the same time that Gonnet was laboring on the first volume of his Clippius Theologiae, Blaise Pascal was growing more and more disgusted with what he considered to be the disingenuous half-life of the De Auxilius controversy between Dominicans and Jesuits at a tense moment of the 17th century Jansenist condemnations in France. In the first letter, dated January 1656, of his satirical and caustic book, Provincial Letters, Pascal, writing under the nom de plume Louis de Montalt, records an imagined conversation with a Dominican theologian. Pascal was intent on getting to the bottom of the predestination controversies. Specifically, he wants to learn from a legitimate neo-Thomist, this is what he calls them, about how the Thomistic school reconciles the dynamics of grace and human freedom in a way really distinct from both Jesuit Molinism and Port Royal Jansenism. Unfortunately, Pascal is not impressed with the Dominican's answer to his questions. Again, this is a hypothetical, imaginary encounter. After listening to the Thomist's explanations, he responds, quote, "To tell the truth, Reverend Father, I am very much afraid that all this is pure quibbling. And whatever comes of your meetings with the Jesuits, I venture to predict that even if the censure is passed, peace will not be established." This statement embodies Pascal's frustrations with the terminology and distinctions that characterize the Thomistic school on this topic. One Pascal scholar summarizes the essence of Pascal's angst in this way. He says, "The Thomists, especially the Dominicans, who were committed as an order to St. Thomas, turn out to be in agreement with the Jansenist theologian Arnauld on everything except the use of terms, and to agree with the Molinists, especially the Jesuits, their recent enemies, on nothing but the use of terms." Ultimately, Pascal concludes that these are debates between theologians, not about theology. He says, "We who are not doctors are not concerned with their quarrels." The real impetus motivating Thomism, he judges, is one more closely aligned with ecclesial politics than it is with the truth. Arguably, Pascal would have benefited from a careful reading of Gonet's Clippius Theologiae. His Provincial Letters remains a delightful book. I sincerely enjoy it very much. Delightful and not completely without penetrating insights that amuse as well as challenge its readers and even its Thomist readers. His letters reflect his rightly acknowledged philosophical and literary genius. Nonetheless, Pascal does not seem fully to appreciate how, for Thomists, the doctrine of predestination is not reducible to the distinction between sufficient and efficacious grace. Without doubt, ecclesial directives, political concerns, and historical events have indeed shaped how Thomists have framed and articulated their predestination doctrine. It would be gravely inaccurate, however, to reduce the contours of Thomist predestination to exclusively extrinsic causes and concerns such as these. The doctrine of predestination lies at the very heart of the nuanced yet very real unity of Thomism's philosophical and theological tradition. This bold claim may sound exaggerated. I propose, however, that historical contingencies and political motivations would be incapable of adequately accounting for the hundreds of pages devoted by members of the Thomist tradition to the doctrine of predestination before, during, and after the De Auxiliis and Jansenist controversies. Other distinctively Thomistic positions that are equally associated with heated historical controversies have not received the same degree of perennial interest and attention within the school. Even when Thomists disagree themselves about nuances and aspects of the tradition's main predestination contours, they all agree that it is important. And this agreement seemingly arises on an even instinctual level. It is not uncommon to meet disciples of St. Thomas who found themselves first drawn to this school precisely because of his predestination doctrine. This was how Father Bonino and I became friends. I was a student brother, and I was asking about Thomas, and within 2 seconds, we're talking about predestination, and he asked me, "When did you first discover predestination?" And I said, "That was the first thing." And St. Thomas goes, "Me also," he says. Indeed, instead of a historical or political account, I propose that speculative and theoretical reasons alone can account for predestination's central importance for Thomism. Predestination is something like a cohesive doctrine, an axis in which the distinctive philosophical and theological convictions of Thomism converge. Few other doctrines enjoy such direct contact with and relevance for as many other doctrines in the Christian faith as predestination. The centrality of predestination within Thomism is both derivative and causative. It is derivative insofar as it, predestination, emerges in its robust and formalized expression from philosophical principles and other already formulated theological conclusions. It is not possible to arrive at the full intelligibility of Thomistic predestination in something akin to a doctrinally quarantined context or environment. Causatively, the shape of Thomistic predestination directly affects positions on other doctrines, characteristic of other dogmatic theological and moral theological nature. Predestination is linked to virtually everything else in the Thomistic expression of sacred theology. Of course, not all Thomists nuance predestination in exactly the same way, but all major Thomists agree about the fundamental principles, the ultimate conclusion, and the almost universal importance of this doctrine for the Christian faith as a whole. And so we ask, why is this the case? And the answer proposed is, for Thomism, ours is a contingent and therefore predestinated universe. A universe contingent and predestinated. Thomism is not fixated on predestination because of controversy, but rather because of universality. In order to specify what type of universality serves as the speculative backbone within Thomistic thought on predestination, it is fitting to center our inquiry into predestination around the one in whom predestination is found. St. Thomas Aquinas is unequivocal about the one in whom predestination is found. Predestination, he says, is something within God, not within creatures, as Father Legg has emphasized. He says, quote, oh, this is actually Cajetan. So Cajetan's explaining St. Thomas. Cajetan says, eternal life, which consists in the divine vision, is an end surpassing the proportion and capacity of created nature. Therefore, a rational creature capable of it, eternal life, is led into it as though transmitted by God. Therefore, the rationale of this transmission pre-exists in God. Therefore, in God, there is predestination. That's what it's like to read Cajetan. It's like you're on a train and the conductor says, the next stop, and you're never getting off the stops because he's just going and going and going, and that's the way it is. Specifically, Thomas and the Thomists locate predestination within divine knowledge. And in his commentary in the Summa Theologiae, Cardinal Cajetan highlights the cognitional nature, as we know, of predestination within God as distinct from the scotistic classification of predestination within the divine will. Moreover, because predestination bespeaks a specific type of order, namely an order to beatific glory, predestination falls under divine providence. St. Thomas explains, quote, all things are subject to God's providence, and it belongs to providence to direct things towards their end. The Thomistic school generally clarifies that predestination is an objective part of divine providence, not a subjective part. The reason for this conclusion is that providence and predestination share equally and fully the ratio of divine order. Quote, this is from Gonet, the providence of God is one, most simple, and virtually distinct, and therefore predestination is not a subjective part of it. Nor is it to be compared to it, providence, as an inferior essential to a superior, whether univocally or analogically. Predestination is in our provident God. Thus, predestination originates from God and is executed in the creature as calling and magnification, vocatio et magnificatio, through grace. Hence, human persons, although they are not the subject of predestination, are certainly the recipients of its effects. The rational creature specifically is the recipient of this providential ordering of God as supernatural end. We can pause here to appreciate the terms, elements, pieces comprised by divine predestination. There is, of course, in first and primal place, God. He is the one in whom the plan of predestination resides, and to whom the effects of predestination terminate. The effects of predestination, however, take place within the metaphysical plane and sphere context of the rational creature. Such creatures are seen to be contingent even within the very and formal ratio of predestination itself. It is important to recognize that the absolute necessity of predestination does not follow essentially from moral defect. We are not predestined because we are sinners. Only. In other words, predestination is fundamentally requisite because of the contingency of human nature, even before and in distinction from contracted, original, or committed actual sin, evil. Were human persons never to have sinned, predestination would still have been necessary. The necessity of predestination vis-a-vis the creature is necessary such that even in the absence of sin, beatific union with God lies outside of the native capacities and the operational reach of contingent beings. We can't get there naturally. This is a point that is consistently accentuated by the Thomist tradition. God is an end beyond the native reach of human creatures, not only because of moral privations, although this certainly compounds the problem, but because of the natural limits of rational contingency. Of course, at this point, we can begin to recognize consonance with the Thomistic emphasis elsewhere upon human nature considered precisely and exclusively as such. And here we invoke the Torah Pura, pure nature. Although the Thomists never believed that human persons were created in portis naturalibus, the ontological baseline that is pure human nature never recedes, even when undergoing the dynamics of grace or fallenness. Analogous to the philosophical principle of prime matter, which is real but not actual, and underlies all instances of composite change or motion, so the contingent nature of human persons necessarily underlies all types of moral and graced change or motion. So that's very important. Pure nature is requisite because just like prime matter, you never encounter it walking down the street, but it's always there because otherwise you couldn't have a supposite continuity or change in change. Similarly, with the dynamics of grace, you need something that can be fallen and can be elevated and can be glorified and still be the same. Without pure nature, you don't have salvation. At best, you have a completely new creation, which would be bad for us because I wouldn't actually be saved. It'd be someone that looks and sounds a lot like me. And that'd be horrible. So, in the actual economy of salvation, however, predestination to glory is effected within human creatures who do suffer original sin and its lamentable effects. But even this salvific dynamic presupposes and accentuates a prior, imminent and fundamentally underlying state of metaphysical affairs. Both salvation from a morally compromised condition and the very fact of being able to be in a morally compromised position presuppose necessarily contingency, rational contingency. The very fact that human creatures are fallen and can be redeemed while remaining what they are, as fallen and as redeemed, contingent beings of a rational nature, this very fact points to contingency itself as foundational for the ratio of predestination. The reality of sin is, therefore, a specifying quality of the fundamental and underlying essence of our contingent nature. Admittedly, sin is not unimportant in the ratio of predestination, but it is not the fundamental reason for predestination. Sin itself is only actual because of the underlying contingency that can bear the state of original sin, as well as grace, transformation, or deification, as well as glorification in heaven. The terms then around which the dynamics of predestination proceed thus possess several key distinctions. First, the distinction between the predestinator and the predestinated. Next, and to speak perhaps paradoxically given our topic, the prior distinction between the creator and the creature, or between he who is pure act and contingent being. It is within this context, namely the context of the real distinction between the creator and the creature, between the predestinator and the predestinated, that the underlying speculative infrastructure of all of reality begins to come into clearer view. The divine plan of predestination is a plan of communicable order. This communicable order is receivable by and within human creatures who can be changed. Salvation, of course, is a consummative state in which rational animals are activated by the immediate vision of God as supernatural object. The very fact that this activation, this change, can occur, however, points to the fundamental distinction between the Creator and the created in general, and between the Heavenly Father and the rational creature redeemed by grace specifically. Predestination would be impossible without these terms and distinctions. Were there no distinction between the creator and the created, then predestination would not only be unnecessary, but it would also be impossible. As St. Thomas points out in the Summa Theologiae's examination of the predestination of Christ, only contingency can be the recipient of the effects of predestination. God can't predestine himself, not divinity. We must, he says, quote, attribute predestination to the person of Christ, not indeed in himself, or as subsisting in the divine nature, but as subsisting in the human nature. The underlying metaphysical context required for and presupposed by predestination, thus, is that of the real relation of the contingent to the absolute, and the real dependence of the contingent upon the absolute. It is significant here to observe that Aquinas' presentation of the direction of providence in Summa Theologiae Prima Pars, question 22, explicitly invokes the universal causality of God concluded to in Summa Theologiae Prima Pars, question 2, article 3. The five ways. One is not surprised then by the frequency with which Thomists invoke themes associated with the five ways in their discourses on predestination. As we know, the first way is the way via motion that concludes the unmoved first mover. The existence of the first mover is the only thing that can account for the motion and change that is most evident in the universe. This is what everyone discovers, change in motion immediately. Any motion or change can only but be the result of a first mover and, continuing in the five ways, a universal cause. And the first mover is, per se, essentially distinct from contingent beings. Within this real distinction, a distinction that maintains a real difference between contingent being and the first mover, who is also the uncaused first cause, the positive qualities of contingent being at their deepest level comes into view. So this doesn't beat down creation. It shows what we are, clarifies, it's a positive thing. Thus, the real distinction between the creator and the creature is not a negative judgment exclusively. In other words, the creator-creature distinction establishes much more than the fact that the created is not the creator. Indeed, the mechanics of the quinque vie show that the ontological content of contingent being depends thoroughly upon the really distinct creator. Hence, the philosopher can conclude that no part of creation is immune to or separate from the primal and inherent causality of the first cause of the unmoved mover. In other words, that causality extends down to all aspects, all levels of contingent being. And that this dependence establishes and preserves the rationes of contingent being within the universe. Nonetheless, the specifications and limitations of contingency are not relevant only to the priorities of the philosopher. Under the light of faith, the theologian is able to recognize contingency's limits as well as its graced possibilities. Consequently, the dynamics of salvation in no wise escape or lie outside of what is the case within the negative and positive implications of the creator-creature distinction. Therefore, no supernatural effect within the economy of salvation is untouched by and uninformed by what the five ways make explicit. So this point is that salvation and the dynamic of salvation don't shed any of the fundamental dynamics of contingent being, and this is necessary because it's exactly contingent beings of a specific nature that we wish to save. How could it be otherwise? Were there to be any principle of natural reality that resides outside of God's universal primal causality, contingent beings, precisely as contingent, would be impossible. And this extends to all aspects of contingent reality, even to human freedom. So human freedom, which is contingent, is not outside of the reach of God's first and universal causality. Thus, even the dynamics of free choice presuppose and depend upon the order of reality that the five ways trace. Of course, the creature's real distinction from and dependence upon God as first cause, the consequent and universal scope of divine providence, as well as the specific order, object of predestination, do not solve all the mysteries of the Christian life. But this doesn't denigrate them, because they then serve as the foundation for our scrutiny of these mysteries. We know the pieces on the board that we have to work with as we seek to contemplate the dynamics of predestination and the other mysteries of the Christian life. The first way traces the contours of the real distinction from the creature to the creator, as we know via a posteriori discursion. Predestination, as we also know, is the formal principle of human salvation. This salvific order from the creator, who is now seen not only to be creator, but also redeemer, is the first starting point of predestination. And this explains why natural human reason cannot conclude to predestination, because the specific term of predestination is a supernatural term that exceeds the limits of natural human discovery, much less natural human attainment. God alone is the supernatural end of the rational creature. Therefore, any act specified by a supernatural end, objectivity, having a supernatural objectivity, must exclusively proceed from the one who is himself the divine end. No other origin and causality of the salvific movement would or could suffice for this motion. A posteriori conclusion to he who is per se in the five ways and the divinely revealed fact of predestination serve as two sides of the same coin. And although these sides of the coin each retain a certain distinction and integration, one cannot compromise the integrity of the one side without thereby also necessarily compromising the other. A posteriori discursion of this sort works because it traces the inescapable steps of reality and arrives at a necessary conclusion, universal and first causality. The contingency that characterizes necessarily predestination and the work of salvation fall within this necessary and inescapable universal causality. All of our created reality, everything from the lowest subatomic particle to the highest angel, participate in our five ways universe. And necessarily and consequently, all aspects of Christian salvation only occur within this five ways universe, including predestination. If the philosopher experiences an appropriate and understandable intimidation before pure act, this awe is understandably intensified and augmented when it comes to the reality of Christian salvation. If it amazes natural reason, reason alone, that there is a being whose first and primal causality extends universally to contingent beings in all of their respective dimensions, how much more is human reason, when illuminated by the light of faith, stupefied before the prospect of salvation? The beatific vision, as divine revelation in its written form tells us, is beyond what any eye has seen, any ear heard, or the mind of any one conceived, except for the divine mind. All of this explains why, in the Secunda Pars, Thomas and his disciples are most attuned to the dynamics of contingent beings created ad imaginem Dei. Herein, we see the natural and supernatural dynamics of creatures as ordered to the supernatural end. That's why the Secunda Pars is so long and complicated, because when you enter grace into contingency, you have a lot of moving parts. It's both exhaustive and at times exhausting to go through it with St. Thomas, particularly in the Secunda, which is why I'm grateful that Father Pine teaches that here, and I don't do that anymore. Herein, we see the natural and supernatural dynamics of creatures as ordered to the supernatural end. The journey towards the supernatural end requires and presupposes both creaturely and divine specification. The distinction and integration of the acquired and the infused moral virtues, the theological virtues, the gifts of the Holy Spirit, the Beatitudes, etc., are all framed around the human capacity to perform acts that bear our supernaturally specified, supernatural objectivity. They render the journey of salvation intelligible, however, only within the creator-creature distinction. Likewise, with the Christological and sacramental considerations of the Tertia Pars of the Summa Theologiae. Sacramental causality for the Thomists is inherently linked still to the dynamics of God's being and universal causality, because the sacraments are separated instruments of our redeeming Lord, instituted and utilized by the conjoint instrumentality of the predestined humanity of Christ. Predestination permeates the life of the sacraments. More specifically, as is well known by students of the Thomist tradition, here we cite our dear colleague here, Father Lynch, sacramental causality is heralded as an example of causality that is classified as physically perfective. This reference to physical in the classification of sacramental causality is, of course, not without deliberation and intentionality in the Thomist tradition. This nomenclature and this type of causality are inherently linked to the intimacy of the causality that the first and universal cause exercises, even within the deepest recesses of our humanity. Thus, physical pre-motion physical causality, physical premotion now, is a necessary corollary of God's being and causality, as well as the creature's real dependence upon God for their being and operations. Ours is a universe of motion, yes, but also of premotion. So sometimes Thomists speak today as if physical premotion were essentially something reserved to the order of grace. And maybe the terms, it's true, the terms can be, when you enter into the domain of human freedom and rationality, but the essence is still the same. Even the bird flying, the grass blade growing, that's the same mechanics that we find within the motion of God within human cognition and volition. So in other words, physical premotion is not something that is exclusive to, in its essence, the context of the human creature. Ultimately, however, the reason why the Thomist school emphasizes the dynamics of predestination is nothing less than and nothing other than human salvation. If predestination is true, and predestination is the formal principle of our salvation, then all graced human activity ordered toward salvation participate in and benefit from an awareness of how predestination works. Predestination helps one live the Christian life. Such dynamics are most acutely recognized in this life within the discrete moments of conversion. We recall, of course, that predestination, as the great Father Garrigou Lagrange has rightly emphasized, is predestination to glory. Nonetheless, as he also recognizes and emphasizes, within this predestination to glory, there falls, of course, the divine plan with regard to the means to glory, grace, the same in gloriae, as well as the recipients of grace, which are, grace, the essential and inescapable principle in this life, as ordered to the glorified life of the next. How, when, and where one receives grace is the context of predestination's practical implications. We recall that the saints have emphasized in their writings the importance of the doctrine of predestination. Here we can cite Louis-Marie Grignon de Montfort. He starts his very pious books. First thing we got to do, remember predestination. Very surprising for readers of tan books sometimes. Just that this is what he hits you in the face with. And for priests, this is where to encourage the seminary priests and brothers here. We live in, you see it every day, because anytime someone jumps into the confessional, you know predestination, the effects of it, in terms of grace as ordered to glory, are already at work. We're not waiting for grace to kick in. It's already started, because they wouldn't be here unless grace were already at work. For the Thomists, predestination is not thus, then, an ethereal doctrine. All practical elements that contribute to human salvation here and now fall within this doctrine's order. Everything, from the minister and the recipient of the sacraments, to the dynamics of prayer, to struggles with grave sin, even of a habitual nature, to miracles and gratuitous graces, all of these are only intelligible within the mechanics of salvation that predestination establishes within our contingent universe. For the Thomists, essentially different, alternative configurations of predestination ultimately require or imply some mutability within he who is pure act and esse ipsum per se subsistens. And any such mutability, basically, this would import the contingency that what we've emphasized characterizes our universe to God. Let's share some with God. That's the concern of the Thomists. Any such mutability shared with God necessarily and inherently implies and requires some degree of imperfection. You can't change without potency, and potency is a principle of limitation, and that's imperfection. Not evil, but imperfection. And any imperfection within he who is esse ipsum per se subsistens necessarily implies a certain impotence. And any impotence implied within the divine being would have deleterious effects both for the constitution of natural reality and the redemption of rational creatures. Ultimately, what Thomism fears is that alternatives to this, let's say roughly the Augustinian Thomistic presentation of predestination, it makes God unable to guarantee our salvation in the contingent world. It's not one option among many. That's their fundamental conviction. Here, of course, we are not engaging in an extended and adequate appreciation. Notice I didn't say critique. Appreciation of Molinism or congruism. The fundamental concern of the Thomist tradition with these theories, however, these alternative proposals, is that they all inadvertently, perhaps, but truly, result in an error that renders human salvation improbable at best, if not impossible. Now, we have our problems too. As Father Legge pointed out, everyone has to bite the bullet in predestination. Thomists have to bite the bullet of the problem of evil. We do have to bite that bullet. But as if I had to pick that bullet versus contingency in God, I'll bite that bullet every day. So, conversely, Pelagian, Jansenistic, and even some Protestant errors about predestination render the human creature either immune to God's first and primal causality, or such primal first causality unnecessary for human redemption. Thomism and our five ways universe can countenance neither of these results. Both errors result in grave distortions of God and of the creature. And because salvation is nothing else than the rational creature's union with the one true God, supernaturally, the stakes are high, and thus the discourse concerning these errors often vehement. In conclusion, is it true that Thomists are preoccupied with predestination? Yes. And the reason they're preoccupied with predestination is that nothing less than God, creation, the human person, angelology, Christology, the sacraments, virtue, prayer, human salvation, in other words, the entire universe and the whole of the Christian faith and Christian life within the one five ways universe, all of these are at stake. Why is Thomism so fixated on predestination? The answer, because all of reality is contingently fixed in being, and God graciously calls created beings to be beatifically fixated on him. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.